that I spoke of before, of people to their local territory, of people to each other, of people to their fish and animal resources. Subsistence as a way of life, then, is definitional. We are this group of people who do this and engage in this particular activity. Then there are finally also more technical, legal, and political grounds on which subsistence rights continue to be placed. Certainly, although ANCSA has specific language with regard to Aboriginal hunting and rights, many Alaska Native leaders speak to the legislative history of ANCSA, which points to the clear indication in the intent of Congress that the state of Alaska should protect the subsistence rights of Alaska Native peoples. And they speak of that legislative history as delegating that authority for the protection to the state. Furthermore, there is another legal and political ground in ANCSA itself that is spoken to. That has to do with the retention of what is called the trust responsibility. That out of the trust responsibility to Alaska Native people, the federal government continues to have a legal obligation to the protection of the subsistence rights of Alaska Native peoples. The question of the legal and political rights is also pointed to in the ANILCA legislation, specifically Title VIII, which sets out and establishes a regime for the protection of Alaska Native subsistence rights. But the point that I want to make at this particular point, and that is done in the context of a definition of rural subsistence rights, which are labeled as those rural rights to subsistence is labeled as being available both to non-Native and Native practitioners of subsistence in rural areas. The other aspect of ANILCA, which is spoken of in terms of the legal right and basis, is the invocation or the speaking to the constitutional authority of the federal government through the what is called the Commerce Clause for exercising a trust responsibility to Alaska Native peoples. So here too then is spoken, ANILCA once again then confirms in many Alaska Native viewers' eyes that fundamental federal responsibility to the protection of Alaska Native subsistence rights. These grounds then are what I perceive and to be the kinds of grounds that are normally advanced in the context of the discussion of the basic rights. Those basic rights key back into that definition of subsistence, what subsistence is, why it is that people want to protect it. And with those introductory remarks, I think that we can explore those basic issues with the audience.
Thanks very much, Steve. Maybe just before we leave you, you could indicate in what regions of the state of Alaska you think the subsistence economy, subsistence activities are still most prevalent. Is it possible to state that?
Well, the subsistence economy is everywhere existent in one form or another. In terms of the numbers of people directly supported by it, it is probably most vital from Western Alaska, from Bristol Bay on north, all the way around to the Canadian border, and in the villages of interior Alaska, where these populations are fundamentally, their existence depends upon their ability to produce from the naturally occurring resources. Let me make a couple of other demographic remarks, which I think you were leading to here, and that has to do with the size of the Alaska Native population that is presently covered by the protections of ANILCA. Because the protections of ANILCA, speak only to rural Alaska Natives, based upon the 1980 census, it covers approximately 75% of the Alaska Native population is covered under that ANILCA requirement. That means approximately 25% of the population is not covered by those ANILCA provisions because they're currently residing in what are defined as urban contexts.
Yeah, Tony.
I would like to present a question that you just asked Steve in terms of identifying a subsistence economy. I think the definitions that he gave for defining what subsistence is, including the moral rights, the cultural rights, and the legal political rights, should also be used in terms of the question that you asked him in terms of the economic identification. To simply identify a subsistence way of life based on the economy is looking at only one aspect. And I suspect Steve's answer should cover all the other definitional regimes that he described.
Woody.
In discussing the definition of subsistence, I think we should begin first by discussing the people, native people. And I'd like to, at some point, be able to distinguish the difference between how natives perceive subsistence and differentiate it from non-native peoples. First of all, in a functional system of beliefs, traditions. And so subsistence is more than an economic system. It's the embodiment of spiritual beliefs. The native languages are not mere accumulations of words, but over the thousands of years it took to develop the native languages, each specific language describes the special relationship between the people who speak that language and their environment. The tribes or bands, whatever we might want to call to them, these political entities to whom each native person is a member to one identifiable group, have their own culture-specific system of spiritual beliefs and moral values. They have a unity of language, of history, culture, creation, tradition, and environment. So I think we have to talk about subsistence as more than an economic system, but the totality of a system of beliefs and practices that not only describe the people's relationship to the environment, but also, I guess in a Christian sense, you would say the relationship to God. In Haida, we have a word we call Sukhanawai. I'm not too sure if I've pronounced it correctly, but the closest definition that I could find was the power of the creating that's on the wind, which means that the power that went into creating the universe, went into creating animals, went into creating, say, this table and me was all the same. Therefore, we are related. So everything is I am related to everything. Everything is related to me. I must treat them with respect, which is, I guess, would contrast by the traditional Christian belief, and I don't deny it, that God gave man dominion over the earth, over the water, the fishes of the water, the animals of the land, and so on. So I think we have to look at this in terms of more than a mere economic system, and also distinguish the difference between indigenous people who have long traditions of involvement with the environment and the non-native people who view hunting and fishing, for the most part, their rights come from the English common law in which wild animals.
So this is just a little clarification on how that works. Whether that's good or not is a separate question, but simply by taking the populations of the four named communities and adding them up, those are not necessarily the only native Alaskans that would not qualify. For example, the Kenai Peninsula does not qualify for subsistence fishing, and that is not a named community in the legislative history.
Just one point you made, Larry, about the state constitution. I take it the state constitution provides that
Fish and game resources are the common property of all the people of Alaska, something like that?
Yes. And that all people shall be treated equally with regard to race, creed, or color. And the state has taken the position, at least so far, that although the federal government has a special relationship with Alaska Natives as a political entity, the state does not have that same the same relationship technically, and so cannot negotiate as a political group, or cannot treat Natives separately as a political group.
Thank you. Steve Behnke.
Thank you, Justice Berger. I wanted to mention that I'm basically here as a resource to explain how the state is involved with subsistence issues, and also to learn and to listen. There have been a lot of interesting things tossed out here. I also wanted to mention that my job as director of the division, which is responsible for compiling information throughout the state about subsistence uses, my job would be a lot easier if there were some way to define subsistence uses in terms of native interest. But basically, a lot of the information that we compile goes into allowing the boards of fisheries and the board of game to identify what uses are customary and traditional uses. And obviously, that would be a lot simpler and easier. Although, as others have pointed out, probably not politically palatable.
That's Caleb and then Marie.
Yes, I want to expand or ask Larry on this definition of customary and traditional uses. It's something that been thrown around for some time, and yet nothing has been really specifically designed to address that. And I think if you look at the regulatory regimes that have been developed by the boards of game and fisheries, that they have not really addressed that issue, and that the seasons and the bag limits and those kind of things that are addressed in those regulations do not address customary and traditional use at all. And I think it's something that the state will eventually need to address, mainly because state has been addressing land mammals, land resources. You haven't really been, since the marine mammals have been under the federal management, there's been, in essence, no regulations concerning marine mammals. But if the state was to take management, then they would have addressed that. And I think it's something that the state needs to address very closely, because it is out there, it is in the law, and yet it has not been addressed.
Maria?
I was going to say basically the same thing as Caleb was saying, that there are traditional subsistence laws, within the communities. They have their own laws, basically their own structure on how they hunt, what is acceptable, what is not. And it exists out there. And what's been happening the last several years, several decades, is with the new federal government, the state government coming in and basically imposing laws without clearly understanding or going out to see what is out there, has created a lot of confusion. Many times we've had to clarify what is meant by which law.
Tom Lunner and then Woodrow.
I think that Marie's made a very excellent point, that the laws that were used to control subsistence prior to the state subsistence law were done essentially without any specific recognition for subsistence and what would be meant by customary and traditional use, or just the basic necessities of life in rural Alaska. I think one of the points that needs to be made is that the state did not adopt the state subsistence law willingly. It was a process, the end result of a great deal of pressure around the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act and the coming D2 legislation. The state was essentially behind the power curve by easily 10 or 20 years in terms of its knowledge to create such a subsistence law. It did it in a hurry-up fashion with a great deal of pressure, and its implementation, and I think that Steve's experience probably was the same as my own in trying to direct some of this, is predominantly economic. If you look at the language of the state subsistence law, while it talks about customary and traditional uses, it very rapidly reduces those to economic uses only and then proceeds to limit those. Now, if that, the law apparently, in terms, a lot of people claim authorship to the state subsistence law and to the language that's there. And what's so fascinating about it is that those persons who thought they were attempting to protect subsistence by adopting such a law, immediately on enacting it, in fact, tended to limit what was meant by subsistence and what criteria one could use to measure it. So that when we turned around a few years later and adopted these subsistence criteria, we're trying to expand it back to what Tony was talking about and what Woodrow was talking about, trying to get back into patterns of tradition and custom and so on and get off of this purely economic mode that the state had adopted in its very protective subsistence law. It was a very dangerous thing that we all did back in 1978.
Larry, did you want to say something?
Yes, I thought it might be useful to briefly summarize what the state subsistence law does, and then partly respond to Caleb's point that it doesn't seem to be being implemented very rapidly. Before 1978, in Alaska, for the benefit of those that aren't from Alaska and may not be familiar with this, regulations for hunting and fishing are adopted by the State Board of Fisheries and the State Board of Game. And before 1978, before the state subsistence law was adopted, the boards could authorize uses, subsistence, commercial, sport uses, completely in their discretion. It was up to
about that, because in Heidelberg we have the same situation. We had a young man was trolling. He caught a small halibut. And while he's trolling, this young boy sitting out in the cockpit, fish and game guy came alongside, said, "Can I come aboard?" And the boy said, "Yes." Fish and game guy came aboard. This Haida skipper was sitting down in the galley. He'd fried the halibut and was eating it. He was cited, and the halibut was taken from his table as evidence that he'd violated the law. Another one, we use a spear to get fish. It's a large hook without a barb that detaches from the end of the pole. Guy from home got an old dog salmon called Kinga. It's turning white, you know, gonna die. And a humpy to use in a crab pond. Fish and Game arrested him because he didn't have a permit for those two fish. And it goes on and on. They confiscate guns. People are hungry, to need to go and get the deer. They get arrested for that. Same for birds. I grew up as a commercial fisherman from the time I was 7 years old. But I also grew up, I would say, in a traditional way of honoring those ways.
Steve, did you want to...
I just wanted to make a brief remark about some of Austin's and Woodrow's comments, is that, for the record, it's the people of southeastern Alaska who've endured the regulatory burden the longest because of the course of the history of Alaskan development. But the traditional harvesting methods of the Tlingit people, were outlawed before Austin Hammond was born. In 1896, the traditional techniques were already being constricted. They were told they could no longer catch the fish in the streams anymore. And it's been that long that that regulatory burden of customary and traditional has been endured. And I just wanted to make that point for the record.
I'd like to say about what they're saying, that law. When I was 9 years old, I was in Chilkoot, 1910, they were buying fish from Chilkoot Lake. And Chilkoot side, all over, came up then fishing. They buying to the canneries. So I think it knows about fishing. They stopped it. Just before that, when the white man came to Alaska, like Chilkoot side, there was a trap they put it in, piling. And the Chilkoot side, they had some traps all around. This is what's coming. So our chief from Chilkat and our side, Chilkoot chief, they got together and they see what they're doing. They're going to kill all this fish. There will be no more fish in Chilkat and Chilkoot. They see ahead of time before you white people come around. We don't use no trap ourselves, our trinket. So they decided to have a second meeting to bring all the young people, young boys, when they get together. The two of the chiefs said, you go on this side.
Errors, which taken together combine to create the potential for disaster. The most important errors occur in law and regulation, scientific wildlife management, scientific human management, land use change, man-made environmental change, and political change, all in concert with natural environmental change. And I'd like to address each of these in turn. Law and regulation. Prior to the enactment of the state subsistence law in 1978, there were a great number of regulations which severely limited, in law, if not in reality, the ability of rural people to continue to take and use resources as they had in the past. These limitations were justified on the grounds of biological necessity, management convenience, or increasing competition for the resource. Not surprisingly, these limitations reflected power relationships, not only among the competing users, but the political constituencies related to these users. Prior to 1978, regulations had been implemented which masked the usurpation by new user groups or industries of resources already committed to subsistence. The regulations were sustained by non-binding policies adopted by the regulatory boards, public testimony to these boards, and a lack of basic inquiry and information on the uses being restricted. With the passage of the state subsistence law, rural people did not have the right to take fish and wildlife as they had in the past, but had only a right to certain procedures preceding the making of regulations governing their use. The state expressed no new interest in the protection or enhancement of subsistence or the resources upon which it was based. No new opportunities for subsistence were created by the law. All that could be achieved was some small return of what the state had taken away during the first two decades of state wildlife management. This return did not result in an expansion of harvest in most cases, but only a legalization of harvest that had continued as it had to in violation of state regulation. It made the subsistence enterprise more legal, not more productive. Rural people did not receive more resources, but were relieved of the legal liability they ran when engaging in their normal harvest pursuits. As currently constituted, implemented, and enforced, laws and regulations directly governing harvest are among the smaller impediments to or supports for subsistence. This remains essentially true as long as Alaska Natives are willing to violate these imposed unnecessary and inappropriate limitations, and as long as they have powerless roles in the enactment, implementation, and enforcement of conservation measures. It may be a terrible waste of time and energy for Alaska Natives to invest much hope or confidence in passing better regulations to protect and enhance subsistence when other, much larger, unseen, and uncontrolled forces are drastically altering it. Creating better and better laws to allocate fewer and fewer resources does not seem worthwhile in the long run. I am certain that Professor Langdon will forgive me if, as a consequence of my low opinion of management regimes, I suggest that his report really begins on page 68 when he introduces the guiding governmental concepts of least adverse impact, and on pages 72 and 73 the ill-defined and ill-operationalized concept of significant restriction. Both concepts suggest, I think without support, that separate and individual limitations can be placed on subsistence without quickly and inevitably creating a very large accumulation of very significant damage to subsistence. Let me briefly comment on one limitation to which I contributed and which we discussed earlier this morning. Having been the author of the state's which were originally 10, I was edited out, 8 criteria for recognizing subsistence, I agree with Professor Langdon that such regulation-guiding definitions must, even in the near term, result in some damage to subsistence. The more tightly these criteria are applied, the smaller the group of subsistence harvesters there will be allowed to be, and the larger the group of personal recreational and commercial harvesters will be. In the end, subsistence use in certain areas will be defined out of existence in law and regulation. By way of explanation, I must note that these criteria were developed as the state was attempting to define subsistence out of existence in Cook Inlet East Side fisheries. Social scientists, if not social science, won a minute battle, really only a holding action, although through this mechanism, but may have contributed to much more serious long-term damage. That is one reason that I am considerably less confident that social science, as currently operated and used, is a stalwart retainer in the survival of subsistence through law. Scientific wildlife management. In Alaska, a great deal of faith is placed in the notion of scientific management, as if the neutrality, objectivity, standards, methods, and logics of science would automatically result in the protection and enhancement of subsistence. Here we are again, relying on Western concepts and methods to protect an indigenous system of wildlife and human harvest, when the most serious danger to the system is posed by this and other Western forces. Is it not incongruous to think that the imposition of more Western forces will rescue subsistence from this danger? Scientific management is applied to both elements of subsistence, the resource base, both wildlife and habitat, and the human harvesters dependent on the resource. In fact, most of the management is aimed at the human harvest.
We could if anyone wishes to do so, reflect or discuss what Gary has said before moving on to Don, or we can move on to Don right now. Well, perhaps we'll do that then, Don.
Okay, well, thank you. There was a method to my madness in reversing the order of Gary and myself, since I've seen Gary do that before, and generally he so bums everyone out with cosmic questions about what is the meaning of life that when someone shows up with the happy answer that there isn't any, and that let's look at it in a much more mechanistic way, a lot of people are very thankful. So that's why I wanted to get a lot of you off the hook. A couple things before I get into my remarks, just in terms of setting the context. First of all, having been a mechanic in this business for a fair number of years now, I have some views on the matter, and those views change constantly, and I may disown them tomorrow morning, at least the ones that I state this afternoon, but whatever the views are, they're my own. They don't reflect any members of the Native community or any Native organizations that I might be associated with on these issues. Just I realize that's pretty obvious, but it's always helpful to mention that, particularly to the press. Second issue, it probably comes as no surprise to anyone if I fess up and admit that I am neither an Alaska Native nor a biologist. So I'm not competent to talk about this very interesting subject from either the point of view of the Native community itself or from the point of view of what's good for the resources that are the object of all of this. The last thing I'd like to mention is that as I look around this table, at least those of us who live in Alaska, most but not all of us have engaged in hours and hours and hours of discussion about what the point of all this is and how best to accomplish whatever the point might be and what's been good and what's been bad. And we could continue to do that for days if in fact that's the drill. But it's my understanding that actually the point of this whole inquiry is what does all this have to do with the Native Claims Settlement Act? And so I will attempt ultimately to answer that question. And I think that it's a much easier question to answer than some of the questions that Gary has thrown out on the table. Starting with all of those ground rules in place, it seems to me that the first thing we could do is to try and very mechanically separate the issue. when I look at the regulation of subsistence, whatever that means for the moment, it seems to me that it breaks down into three subjects. The use of the land, the regulation of native people in terms of their taking a particular resource for the purpose of personal or local consumption, and then also, interestingly enough, the use by Alaska Natives of the very same resources in order to sort of shuffle the cards very quickly and, just like the rest of us, turn those resources into money. And I think that the use of subsistence resources by the native community for access to the non-native economy is a very interesting and overlooked part of this whole situation. So starting with that, I think it might be helpful in terms of looking at what ANCSA has done or not done to think about, again, in a very mechanical, non-native sort of point of view, what the historical situation has been. And let's take primarily the regulation, at least for wanted to clean up its act. I would suggest, as Harold has sort of alluded to, that the habitat issue associated with maintaining what integrity the subsistence economy has left may be even more important. But as I said, I didn't get into it originally because it hasn't really been relevant to discussing ANCSA.
Yeah. Thanks, Don. Steve wanted to add something.
I wanted to ask Harold to, just to follow up on the question of the importance of the mechanisms for the Hooper Bay Agreement with regard to the authorities vested in the AVCP and the Waterfowl Conservation Committee, the importance of jurisdiction being defined as tribal, and in the how was that seen or arrived at in this particular case?
I heard hand that when California agreed to go along with federal proposed regulations, that the sovereign state of California said that yes, they would agree with this unless the governor of the sovereign state of California could make an agreement with the president of the sovereign nation of the Association of Village Council Presidents to cut a better deal for California. So many of the sovereign people who are quite interested in sovereignty in our region thought that was a very very nice statement by the state of California. The people have maintained that if they ever stop being Eskimos and Athabascan Indians, they're lost. They'll get trashed in any allocation decision, and the sovereignty issue, again, this is my perspective. The sovereignty issue has generated itself because of this threat to the way of life that the people want to maintain. And the Association of Village Council Presidents was very insistent that the relationship of the all the parties in this agreement had to be the villages, the individual village entity. It was they who, under peer pressure, would control voluntarily the habits, or change, modify the habits of the hunters there. Like Caleb was saying earlier, unless you go into the village and tell the guy, listen, this is the way the law reads, and this is what you're supposed to do, most of the people in 1984 still do not know that they're doing a lot of things that they're not supposed to be doing. And frankly, because nobody else wants those resources, there's no pressure on them. In the case of the birds, somebody else wanted those resources, so there was pressure. And again, I believe it was a political reason by AVCP to give the authority to the village entity, which is the tribal governing body of the villages. In some cases, there is no tribal governing body, and in that case, it was a traditional government that was given the authority to work on this agreement.
Peter Usher.
Well, just a reaction as a visitor to the three very interesting presentations that we heard right after lunch. I found myself agreeing with all of them. And so I wondered why that might be, since they all said quite different things. And it occurred to me that really they were talking about some quite different things. And therefore, I wonder, although this roundtable discussion is titled Subsistence, I wonder if in fact there aren't perhaps three different issues that we might be addressing the future of. So perhaps I'll throw them out as possibilities and give you at least a very brief thought, my own brief thoughts on them, and then if some of them aren't valid, we can throw them out. But it seems to me, first of all, we're looking at what is the future of subsistence? And that, it seems to me, is what Lawner and Holdhouse expressed. They, it seems to me, were somewhat pessimistic. I guess if I had to characterize Tom's view of what's happening with subsistence, it would be like one of your generals said about Hue in Vietnam, which was that in order to save subsistence, we had to destroy it. Sometimes I get rather pessimistic about the future of subsistence in the Canadian North as well. But then I think, well, you know, these are to some extent semantic terms. What we mean by subsistence and what other people might mean by subsistence, I think, are quite different. In fact, that's been raised in some of the comments that people have made about the commercial use of subsistence resources. And it seems to me that the conventional non-native use of subsistence is nothing but a hindrance to the way native people would conceive of their resources and might like to use them in the future. There's a long history of the commercial use of so-called subsistence resources, certainly in Canada and I'm sure in Alaska, that to all intents and purposes are traditional. And why we should be hung up on this notion of personal use and so on is quite beyond me. And I think that in our own society, somebody commented on the degree of subsistence life in the non-native economy. I think there's a lot more of it than most of us recognize. I live in an area in rural Ontario where there are a lot of old-time farmers around, and as I look at the definitions, the criteria for subsistence, which I find on page